Hello there, and a warm welcome of sorts to this, the 273rd edition of DF Direct Weekly, our weekly show where we tend to discuss the latest gaming and technology news. And joining me this week, first of all, John Linneman. Hello.
Hey, Rich. Hopefully everybody's in a better mood this week. We can have some fun chats here on DF Direct Weekly. I'm happy. I just made it to Disc 2 on Grandia again last night. One of my favorite RPGs ever, playing through it on the Saturn. Man, what a great game. Really shows off that system well. I love it. Just wish the HD version was based on the Saturn.
Okay. Yeah. What was it? The PlayStation version that was the port there?
Yeah, so that was the thing. As a quick story, when we saw the thing at E3 originally, we were asking the guy showing it to us. Audie was with me. We were like, it's based on the Saturn version? Yep. Saturn version, blah, blah, blah. Like, all right, let's see it. They showed it to us. I'm like, wait, that's the PlayStation version. Because I know exactly what the differences are. And they didn't know what to say. I was just like, you guys just told me this, but it's actually this. Like, what do you... And yeah, it didn't go out well. And then they had the texture filtering, and the guy just looks at us like, is that a problem? And I'm just like,
okay.
So yeah, but still, great game.
Hello, Oliver McKenzie.
Yeah, say I share John's concerns there, perhaps, but hopefully this will be a good episode. I can't believe we're up to 273. We're closing in on 300 rather quickly, I imagine.
Probably surpassed it, including specials.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's move on with our first story of the week. Okay, then. So our lead story for this week, and we're actually taping this one out of sequence because the announcement actually happened after we'd recorded the main direct. So it might look slightly different here. That's because of editing. But there was this remarkable statement that was put out on Twitter, sorry, X, from Bethesda Game Studios, which basically outlined their entire plans for all of their key franchises going forward. Kind of unprecedented, kind of weird. There is the sense that we're seeing more Xbox damage control in the wake of the big Xbox reset disaster, and I do think it is a disaster at this point. But nonetheless, there was a lot of interesting information in there. John, I'm going to go to you first on here. Let's talk about Fallout, because that seems to be seemingly sort of like the focal point of it. We do have confirmation of existing rumors that Fallout 3 is getting a remake, and also New Vegas as well. And also we have confirmation that Obsidian is indeed working on a new Fallout game, which, if I'm right, seems to be something separate to actual Fallout 5. It's not entirely clear, but I think that is the case. What do you make of all of this, and indeed the nature of this announcement in general?
Ooh, it's complicated. Lots of things to carefully walk over. I do think this, and as we'll mention, the id stuff is very much a response to everything that's happened, right? And it is a form of essentially saying, hey, we're still here, and this is what we're going to try to do. Because, I mean, realistically, the studios aren't closed, thankfully, and they're going to try to continue to work ahead and create new things, right? So they're not going to come out and say, yeah, that destroyed all of our plans, we're screwed now, we're not making any more games, we can't make anything, you know. Of course not. So this makes perfect sense to come out and do this, but the timing of it all and the way it's laid out definitely feels like a we have to address this somehow kind of thing. And they're basically laying out what they want to do in the future, and what they want to do kind of ties into, I guess, with what Xbox had said, is that they want to focus on the big franchise stuff, right? And Fallout and Elder Scrolls, they're pretty big, I would say. So it makes sense for them to talk about it. But it definitely feels like, especially with the Fallout stuff, like they're just basically acknowledging that, yeah, we'd like to make that someday, as opposed to actually any progress on it. You know what I mean? Because, like, I think they already made this mistake with the Elder Scrolls 6 when they announced that at the time that they did, because that's way, 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 way too early. They were clearly not focused on it. Like, during that period, they had wrapped up Fallout 76 and they had a team still doing that. And clearly Starfield was the main focus. And whether you liked it or not, Starfield was a very big game. It was a very ambitious game, and it essentially, you know, between Fallout 76 and Starfield was about 5 years, which was pretty long for Bethesda, I would say. Before that, though, it was typically 3 to 4 years between major games. The only exception, I guess 3 years was with Fallout 3. Well, Oblivion to Fallout 3 was very short, uncharacteristically short for Bethesda Game Studios. Yeah, like clearly now they're all in on Elder Scrolls 6 and are essentially acknowledging that they'd like to continue moving forward with Fallout as well. And there's also the remasters announced, I suppose, right? So they're getting remakes. I suspect that that will not be an internal Bethesda Game Studios project, much like the Oblivion remaster. I wouldn't be surprised if it was Virtuous again. Who knows? But another one of those. I mean, they already got Oblivion working. Again, whether you were happy with the results or not, and those results definitely had some issues, that idea of wrapping the old engine in an Unreal Engine 5-based graphical renderer, I mean, it's kind of already done, so it makes sense to expand that to other creation engine games of that generation. So I guess that's what we'll probably see. I mean, it's this stuff's so tricky because, again, like this is a business announcement, right? And they're not going to come out and say the things that people are thinking. It's just going to be about whatever they're working on. So it's hard to really gauge much more than this. But I suspect, I mean, this makes sense logically. Like, this is the path you would have expected for the studio to go down anyways. I think people are just frustrated because, you know, even though the time gap isn't that crazy given their history, it feels longer, I think, because of Starfield and because of Fallout 76, which was not a traditional single player game. So they had this cadence of going back and forth for a little bit between like Fallout stuff and Elder Scrolls stuff. It wasn't actually a long period of time, though. It was literally like 2 games in Fallout and 2 games in Elder Scrolls where they were able to get them done pretty quickly during the 360 generation. And then they continued that cadence with Fallout 4, but then that's when they shifted to doing things in a different way. And by introducing the new IP with Starfield and focusing on the more multiplayer Fallout 76, it did end up feeling like, and it's true, that there's a huge gap between the real single player Elder Scrolls and Fallout games. And the audience has definitely reacted negatively towards that, even though it's not as if Bethesda has been working on this during all this time. They were clear. They're not just sitting there twiddling their thumbs. It's not that there's a gap between them because of that. It's because they were doing other stuff. So,
I mean, the nature of this announcement is kind of weird because basically a lot of this we already knew or could guess.
Yeah, you know,
obviously
exactly.
They're going to be doing Fallout 5. Obviously, they're doing Elder Scrolls 6. A lot of it seems to be kind of like telling us everything is okay. Like, we know that the guys doing Elder Scrolls Online were subject to some really heavy layoffs there, but they're telling us that there's still going to be new content there. But, you know, ultimately, games take a long time to develop, and certainly with the most recent Bethesda Game Studio titles, these take a long time to develop, and there's not going to be any sort of sudden acceleration on that front. Maybe a bit more focus, but you know, the fact remains that these games are huge and take a long time to develop, and I can't see them coming anytime soon. So, you know, the concept of tweeting out on Friday that, okay, this is everything we're going to be doing, sort of kind of bizarre. I guess we got a bit more detail on the remakes and whatnot, and the fact that Starfield isn't being left behind, which is welcome, I think. And I guess, Oliver, we also had confirmation that Elder Scrolls 6 and Fallout 5 will be using a new iteration of the Creation Engine, Creation Engine 3, where, you know, you kind of would expect that for titles that are going to be landing in what is presumably going to be in the next gen timeframe at this point, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you'd think I would be almost assured that both titles will be launching in the next gen timeframe, although I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I think the Elder Scrolls 6 is going to be a cross-generation title of some variety here.
I'm sure they all are, to be honest.
Well, yeah, who knows at this point? Yeah, it could be Fallout 5 and 2038 or something, and we're still looking at cross-gen, I could imagine. But I mean, this is an interesting announcement just because I think a lot of people kind of were thinking, hey, maybe we're going to get some combo of the Creation Engine and Unreal Engine 5. Wouldn't that be something for a title like Fallout 5? But that doesn't seem to be the case, because they're talking about new tools and critically rendering and systems that define our games. So it does sound like it's going to be a all-in approach with Creation Engine. So that's kind of, I don't know, promising in some respects. I mean, I thought that Starfield looked pretty good, actually, for a Bethesda Game Studios title. Obviously, some people like to deride certain aspects of its visual presentation here and there, and it's not perfect, obviously. You know, the game looked pretty good relative to other Bethesda Game Studios titles released in the past. But I am really curious about this whole announcement in general, because, geez, I don't know about what it means, because it's a very strange announcement, because typically, if you're going to announce a whole slate of games like this, you would announce it with a lot of fanfare. You'd have media available.
Yeah.
You'd have maybe screenshots. You'd have at least concept art or something. You'd have Todd Howard out on the stage or in a YouTube video or something talking about it and making it clear to people that, hey, we've got an exciting new slate of titles coming. More realistically, you know, in typical Bethesda Game Studio style, I mean, at least until somewhat more recently, maybe you wouldn't do too much of a blowout in any particular game. Maybe you'd reveal more closer to the date of release. Maybe you wouldn't even reveal them at all until closer to the date of release, right? So this is like just a weird setup, and I kind of wonder if Asha, I mean, I'm sure that Asha had a significant involvement in this given her role, but I think she might have put her thumb on the scale here and said, you have to issue some kind of statement now. And I don't really think it's about meeting gamers where they are, because I think a lot of people were a little bit confused by this announcement, because it's a lot of projects that we either knew were coming or are long rumored. I think it's more to shore up the share price, I suspect, and have more investor confidence, because I don't think investors care that much if you're showing off gameplay of a new title. They just care that it's coming. And this does not seem too calibrated towards gamers in general. I mean, what gamer is going to wade through this lengthy Twitter statement with no pictures, no media? I think Todd Howard did a couple of limited interviews with people like Jason Schreier as well, but he didn't really reveal anything of import or anything too exciting. So yeah, this is just a weird set of announcements that I don't really think is calibrated towards the gaming audience. I think it's calibrated towards people who own Microsoft stock, honestly. I don't really think it's for us.
That's an interesting point, Oliver. I think you might be onto something there. And because this fundamentally, like, so they basically fired like 500 people between the two Bethesda studios, right? Like they let go of a lot of people. Yet here they are presenting significantly more work for them to do in a way that isn't really exciting for anyone except for potentially investors. Just to note that, hey, the studio is still alive. But I feel like this might end up doing some harm, because you just read the comments and there's definitely a sense that people don't really... So like, for instance, when they announced Elder Scrolls 6, right? Mm-hmm. It's pretty obvious that it wasn't actually being made yet, or anything that was being done on it would have been very light pre-production stuff, right? Yeah. Yet you see people down there saying, oh, Elder Scrolls 6 has been in development for 10 years. Maybe Microsoft was right to fire all those people, kind of thing. It hasn't been in development for 10 years. Right. You know, I would say it'll probably only really entered active development after Starfield shipped. So it's like 3 years ago, I guess. So we're definitely at a point where, yeah, they've been hard at work on that. But the public perception is that they haven't been doing anything, or that they should have been developing that. There's also the same feeling about, well, Fallout Show was a big deal, right? So you're telling me they don't even have Fallout 5 in development yet? As if they could have also handled that and Elder Scrolls 6 and Starfield at the same time. And now they're 500 people down. Like, I just don't quite see how all of this stuff is going to come together. And it does feel like something mandated almost from on high, from Xbox side, to essentially assure people that everything is still okay. So I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, there's just basic lack of logic to these layoffs, right? Because they want more from those key franchises, Elder Scrolls and Fallout, but they're doing it with fewer people. It just not make sense. This is not investment It's cuts, right? They're expecting people to do more from less. That's not really great. And it also sort of demonstrates a sort of fundamental lack of respect for the studio, if I may say so.
I agree.
It's just not great. So, you know, we've had all manner of, I mean, obviously the id Software side of things as well. There was a clear sort of damage limitation exercise put into effect there, which it wasn't convincing. Here we have basically an attempt to tell people everything's fine with these key franchises that we really want to invest in. Please don't focus too much on all of the people that we've laid off. It's just, you know, colossal self-harm from Xbox and Microsoft there. It just does not make sense whatsoever. Divesting studios games that aren't producing, you know, gigaton AAA titles, I can kind of see how that jives with their stated strategy of going for the big hitters. But to make cuts to Bethesda Game Studios is just kind of nutty.
Also, Rich, if I may, I think that, and we'll talk about this in the already recorded part of Direct, I think what they're doing here is they're making the classic Xbox mistake of saying too much, and that it would behoove them to just say nothing at this point.
Yeah.
And may I point to something like beyond Sony, which is what we talk about later, which they say nothing and somehow manages to go okay for them, even though that's not great for us, but that's what it is. But Rockstar, right? It's how long have people been waiting for GTA 6? It's a very, 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 very long time. They've had the one game in between, Red Dead Redemption 2, which people also loved. The amount of time it's taking to make that stuff is significantly higher than what Bethesda Game Studios has delivered. And yes, it can be argued that when they do actually release it, it will likely be more polished and so on. That's, you know, they have like infinite time and money to do that. But because they say basically nothing, they remain this like secretive little bubble. I do think that grants them this certain level of like freedom where like, people just don't think about it because they know they're not going to get any information about it until they're ready to give that information. And then when they give that information, they do so by presenting things that gets people excited. Right. Mm-hmm. So saying we're going to make this Elder Scrolls game while showing nothing and then only occasionally acknowledging it over the years and then making things like this, like it rubs people the wrong way because you're not giving them anything in return for it. And that's what gets the conversation going. And it does tend to bring out people that are, you know, I would say in some degrees, rightfully annoyed by that. Right.
Yeah.
But if they just quietly continue to work in the background when they're ready to show it, that's actually the strategy they did with Fallout 4. If you recall, where they showed up at E3 that year and it was like, boom, Fallout 4 is coming out later this year. Let's show you all about it. And it was huge. That was a really big thing that went really well for them. And I think they need to do that again. But it's kind of too late at this point. But that's why I think announcing the existence of a Fallout 5, probably not the best idea, because now it's stuck in that same situation that Elder Scrolls 6 was in. You're going to have a subset of people that think, oh, now Fallout 5 is in development and they're starting the clock right now, right? And when it doesn't come out for 10 years, like, it took 10 years to make that game. It's not fair kind of thing.
Right.
It didn't take 10 years to make, right?
Yeah, it does. You know, there is some merit to your shareholder theory there, Oliver, because to expose that much information to players at this point when the titles are so far out, it's not a great strategy. And speaking of not great strategies, let's talk about what happened during id Software's live playthrough of the Doom the Dark Ages Revelations DLC, where there were some comments made about the recent cuts to id Software there. And we've got creative director Hugo Martin basically saying there's been reports that we've been quote unquote nerfed into the ground and quote unquote gutted, and we have 50 people, and that's not true. We're the size we were when we made Doom 2016, and id Tech is very much alive and well. You have to understand, we have id Tech engineers both in Frankfurt and at Machine Games. We collaborate quite a bit. id Tech is there, the Doom team is there, and we're excited to share with you guys more of what we're working on in the future when it is appropriate and approved. John, I mean, it really does come across once again as damage limitation comments like that, because, you know, basically as I understand it, what was happening in Texas is that basically most of the programmers and the engine guys were let go. He's talking here about id Tech engineers in Frankfurt. As I understand it, there were 12 and there are now 6. So, you know, to kind of downplay that and to say, hey, everything's fine, you know, it doesn't seem, dare I say it, appropriate.
I mean,
but clearly approved.
It has shades of Bethesda stuff as well, where they essentially acknowledging that they're not actually dead and we're going to keep going. I think in the case of id, from talking to people, there is a feeling that maybe Hugo's just being a bit optimistic, but at the same time, he's not necessarily off base. I think he's speaking honestly here. But I think it also doesn't really completely communicate the impact that those people will have had on the games that they developed, right? Like, that was a big loss, and I think pretty much everyone within the studio seems to agree that that was really significant cuts. But it doesn't mean it's actually completely crippled, so there is like a silver lining there. So it'll be I guess that kind of brings us to this whole thing where they mentioned Machine Games, which I guess is something we theorized, that they would have to work more closely with them to keep this stuff going now, because Machine Games always had their sort of offshoot where they were using id Tech, but they did some of their own stuff to it, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm at least happy to hear that it's not gone, but I think by just saying, yeah, everything's fine, it's kind of disrespectful to all the people that were laid off.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically counter-messaging to the people who did actually go public with comments who were laid off.
Yeah. Right?
You know, and that really doesn't come across great. You'd hope to see some sort of level of solidarity there, which doesn't appear to be happening, which is a bit disappointing.
But, Rich, if you got the Xbox bosses breathing down your neck and you gotta, you know, put on that strong face. I mean, absolutely. I don't blame Hugo for making comment like that at all. Like, I get why you would need to do that, right? Like, that's the situation they're in. It sucks, but that's how it seems to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it is still just remarkable that, bearing in mind the challenges ahead for the Xbox lineup of games and the fact they need to justify a new generation to do what they've done to these studios, just doesn't make sense at all. Any final comments, Oliver?
Not too much. I do think, I'm kind of mixed in this Hugo Martin statement. I'm glad, like John indicated, that they seem to have some kind of game plan going forward, but I'm a little bit taken aback by some of the dismissiveness and some of the repeating of that line that, hey, we're the same size as we were when we shipped Doom 2016. And didn't you like Doom 2016? Wasn't that a swell game? I think it's a bit disingenuous given the scale of modern game development. When you're looking at...
Lawyer-approved, maybe.
Possibly lawyer-approved. Definitely ASHA-approved, I would suspect. Because if you look at a title like Doom The Dark Ages, and the scale of that title, and the asset density of that title, and the tech behind that title, you're not shipping that with a team that is, you know, two-thirds the size, half the size.
2016.
And I honestly wonder if they're kind of dancing around something else right now, which is a lot of studios are using a lot of co-development studios nowadays, especially located in, you know, Asian countries, located elsewhere in the world, located in different places. And I do wonder if maybe the solution here is to have id heading up a project, but to rely heavily on co-development. And I know other Xbox studios use co-development quite heavily. When you look at a title like the Halo Campaign Evolved title, I believe that's using co-development quite heavily. I don't think id typically did that much co-development. I know they did some of it, but I don't think that they did that much of it. And I could see that as a viable path going forward for a new Doom title. Let's say if one was to be in the early stages of production, as has been reported in a couple outlets, that would be a viable way going forward. But I don't really think the studio as it stands could deliver another title on the scale of Doom the Dark Ages, at least not easily and not without perhaps an undue expenditure of time or something else, right? Especially if it's on their own technology. So yeah, I do kind of wonder if they would explore alternative development models now that, you know, they've been kind of gutted, as I think Hugo Martin would be inclined to say they weren't, but I think probably third-party reporting suggests they realistically were to some substantial degree.
That's a good point, Oliver, a thing about the co-development stuff, and that's, I think Jason Schreier talked about this weekend on one of his videos, was like, that's also something that these layoffs have had a significant impact on. A lot of these co-development studios, they're not included in those numbers, but they are affected by it. Teams are off projects, layoffs occur at those other studios, and some of these guys can't even talk about the projects they were working on if they weren't publicly announced. I mean, we even saw it from a more public perspective that happened with IO Interactive, right? They had that project they were working on with Microsoft, and Microsoft was funding a lot of it, and they kind of pulled out of that, forcing them to do layoffs as well, despite the huge success of 007. So, like, this stuff has far-reaching effects.
Okay. Well, I think that's all we've really got to say about this one. So I guess we shall now transition seamlessly back to the show that we recorded yesterday. Okay, so we're trying to be positive here, but man, it can be difficult sometimes. And a story came to light this week that we've got to talk about here because it does basically concern, you know, the future of console gaming as far as I see it. So we had this interesting situation here, outrageous almost, I'd say, where basically a Twitch streamer called Joshua Khan basically lost his entire Microsoft account. It was basically closed by Microsoft because it had been compromised. And he lost all of his games, thousands of euros worth of purchases, and personal photographs. Basically, the entire Microsoft account, the OneDrive associated with that particular account, was gone. And, yeah, I mean, basically, it's all been documented online. Before I go on, there has been a happy conclusion to this, but actually that conclusion raises even more questions. But I'm just looking at the initial response that Microsoft gave to Joshua there, and basically saying, at Microsoft, safeguarding your account is a top priority. We have thoroughly investigated the account and billing activity associated with your Microsoft account. Based on this review, we've confirmed that unauthorized access occurred. During the investigation, we discovered that the security information on your account had been changed. Due to our strict security protocols and the terms outlined in the Microsoft Services Agreement, we are unable to modify or restore the security settings once they've been updated. To prevent further misuse, we have permanently suspended the account. This action is irreversible. Actually, turns out it isn't. And ensures that your data remains protected. If you use this account for Minecraft, we regret to inform you the game cannot be recovered. A new purchase will be required on a newly created account. We understand this may be disappointing and sincerely apologize for the inconvenience. Additionally, if you had files stored in OneDrive, those files are no longer accessible. Due to encryption and privacy safeguards, even our engineers cannot retrieve them. Actually, turns out they can. While this outcome may not be ideal, it is necessary to ensure your personal data does not fall into the wrong hands. So basically, what ensued was a complete social media disaster area for Microsoft, and it did turn out that they could actually restore his account. He's been sorted. He's a very happy guy. However, there are big questions here, profound questions, basically, as we transition away into a kind of new digital-only environment for Xbox. And I should say at this point that although this particular story relates to Microsoft, there's no reason why it won't apply to Sony as well. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that have been unduly affected by the kind of terms and conditions associated with digital accounts. John, where do we start with this? Because as far as I'm concerned, there's good points and bad points to this particular story. First of all, it's brought to light severe shortcomings in terms of the policies associated with digital ownership and digital accounts. The good news is that it looks as though those protocols can be circumvented, that they are, you know, that the loss of data and purchases isn't irreversible, as that email said. But at the same time, the fact that Microsoft has basically backed down in what was effectively social media public shaming kind of suggests that the existing protocols are not fit for purpose, and that not just Microsoft, but everybody who's actually sort of pointing us towards this digital-only future, it kind of needs to take stock about consumer protections here and actually respecting the audience.
Yes, Rich, this is a very important topic, and people might be like, "Well, why are you, you know, angry at just this one case, whatever?" It does actually apply to digital ownership, the future of ownership for these types of goods. It relates to how these companies do business and what we should be fighting to prevent. And as you noted, it's very important to note that this is not a Microsoft exclusive issue. I think we talked about it earlier this year. There were cases, and it's still happening, where people's PlayStation accounts are getting hacked, and the same thing occurred. It exactly happened with some other people recently, from what I recall. And it was the same situation where once you get that social media backlash, they restore the account, everything's good. That happened on PlayStation, but a lot of people are left hanging in the wind. And even I talked to somebody yesterday that had this kind of happen with Nintendo, but it was different. It was more like they hadn't used the account for years, and then they got a Switch 2, and then the account was just gone. So that's another thing there. And I think that actually ties into that whole EU thing, which to prevent people from saving data long term, but that's also not really good in terms of like purchases, right? So the whole fight here is to retain ownership of digital goods. Obviously, we've been very upset, especially me, about the removal of physical game options, especially on the Sony side. And I'm happy that a lot of people are continuing to push back against that, so that's great. But whether that can be won and discs restored, that feels difficult to achieve. But what should be also focused on is this thing about digital rights. And right now, as you can see, it's very easy for a company to essentially remove your entire purchase history, in case some cases going back like 20 years, right? I don't think that's acceptable, and I think it should be illegal to do this. And I'm not sure how we can really affect change on this outside of talking about it, but I would like to see this challenged in a way to prevent this from occurring. Because fundamentally, if you spent thousands of dollars on something, or just people could have spent tens of thousands on this stuff over the years, right? Just to have them email you and say, "Sorry, we're taking all of that away." Like, that, in no world should that ever be acceptable. And we can't allow the companies to do this. This is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's outrageous. And basically what's going to happen here is that cases like this will snowball. You know, now there's been public exposure to it, more people will come forward with their stories. And basically what's inevitably going to happen is some sort of regulatory response or legal response. There's going to be court cases, basically, and change has to happen. So it's basically down to the platform holders to try and do better before that happens, to sort of see it off. But, you know, when you sort of see stories like this, as I said, on the one hand, there's hope there, because it turns out the data isn't irretrievable, even though they say it is. But on the other hand, the concept of actually being forced into a response there that's equitable to the user shouldn't really be what the best way forward here. It's kind of crazy.
Most users won't have this option, right? This only resolved in a positive way because this guy had social media connections and was able to get the story out there. Most users don't have this. And Microsoft, Sony, whatever, they're going to give the same kind of BS response where it's like, "Oh, sorry, you know," and it's always written in that specific way that just feels so insulting as well. Very legalese in order to, you know, soften the blow, but the blow is significant.
Yeah. I mean, I do think there are going to be scenarios where there may well be sort of egregious breaches of terms and conditions that could see sanctions against particular users, right? But at the same time, there still needs to be a mechanism in place that's kind of like equitable.
So, Rich, on that matter, I actually think if there is a reason for an account to be blocked from making further transactions, I think at the very least there should be a method for putting an account in a state that prevents them, that does not prevent them from accessing their already purchased products, right? They shouldn't be able to take away your products. If they want to make it so you can't further engage with the system, fine. maybe there's room for that in extreme situations, but they should not be able to simply take away all your purchases like this. That is unacceptable.
Mm-hmm. Oliver, what's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think that sometimes when you're dealing with some kind of security breach, whether it's a bank account or a Microsoft account, or I've seen people have this with Apple accounts, very similar situations, or any other kind of private administrator of data, the easiest thing to do to limit liability is just to say, okay, washing our hands of this relationship and move on for the administration, right, for that company. And at least in some cases, like with a bank, the bank is obligated to give you back your money. In this case, Microsoft isn't obligated to do anything, which seems very perverse. This actually happened with a friend of mine quite recently, where someone got her bank info and tried to withdraw, I think $25,000 from her account. Her bank stopped the transaction and called her about it. But then they said, and we're going to terminate the banking relationship because you're too much of a liability because someone got your info and tried to hack into your account. And then they said they'd send her the money back. And there was this whole hubbub about that. It took ages, and they ended up releasing the money to her. But like in this situation, they only ended up releasing the money to her after she said she would write a story about it in a major American magazine. So that was a big problem in her case. Oh. But yeah, I do think one of the key kind of issues here is I don't think companies should be able to lock your data or delete or lock your data or anything like that as kind of like a first response to an issue like this. People need, I think, a legally enforceable right to human review for cases like this, so they can get a human on the line, explain the situation, and hopefully deal with someone who might be able to be a little bit more flexible or at least release their data in some form. And I do think there should be some kind of right, this wouldn't apply to everything, but some kind of right to transfer possibly purchases, possibly other data across kind of providers of information storage. In this case, when we're talking about Microsoft, we're talking about Xbox. We're also talking about like OneDrive, all your photos, all this stuff, because people have hooked their systems in with all these cloud providers. I don't necessarily agree with that, but it's like they've hooked their entire computing and their entire lifestyle in with one of these providers. So losing access to that information is very traumatic. Even in the, you know, maybe there are some select cases where people do need to be relieved of this information or relieved of access to this information, but it should be transferable to another provider. So yeah, I do think that there should be some kind of push on this. But it does, I think, like you said, John, it does kind of reveal that digital rights to goods are licenses that can be taken away at any time, by anyone's whim at the moment. There's not really any seeming legal recourse to this, not really any seeming political recourse to this at the moment. So I hope that there is some kind of system enforced where companies have to take this more seriously. And in the case of something truly egregious, maybe you have done something really egregious, they are releasing your data to you. They're sending you your photos, sending you your videos, whether that's to another provider, whether that's in like a zip drive or something, a flash drive, who knows. But there needs to be some kind of way to ease this situation, because when it does happen, it's extremely traumatic.
I do like the concept of them sending you a zip drive. That takes me back, Oliver.
A little dated terminology.
It would be all, yeah, why not? Yeah, just like one of those old SCSI optical drives. Yeah. Used to use. Or like, you know, 1,000 CDRs. You know, the thing that I find annoying here is, you know, if you go back to the Microsoft support letter that they sent to Joshua there, it's just full of lies or things that are clearly not true. If we're going to soften that ever so slightly, you know, they did actually get his OneDrive files back. They're saying here that it's even our engineers cannot retrieve them. Well, it turns out they did. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on here.
They lied.
It just seems as though, you know, it's just not based in reality here. It's just not great all around. I mean, you know, we do have quite a big reach with DF Direct Weekly. You know, we've seen the analytics and whatnot. I know there are people from Microsoft and Sony listening to this, and I'm urging you to please do something about this before the regulators get involved, before laws are passed. Maybe they need to be passed anyway, to be honest, at this point, because I'm not sure this kind of like tight iron grip on data is something that's going to be changing anytime soon. But it clearly needs to, because certainly if we're looking at the end of physical media when it comes to game purchases, there are no alternative options anymore. And when you're talking about no alternative options, then you're getting quite close to monopolies, and that is where the state and regulators become involved. And I think ultimately there's also just the concept of just being fair and equitable to your users, right? It's just basic good business at that point. So, yeah, please do something about it, because we're just going to see more cases like this, more apparent hypocrisy and untruths. It's just not a good look going into the next generation. I haven't really got too much more to say about this, but our supporters do. So Alexander Zianov, big business will always prioritize profit, and if we want them to do something pro-consumer, it needs to be written in the law. Arle writes, not really a question, just wanted to add to the discussion. Earlier this week, a Brazilian who sued Microsoft over a deleted account and the loss of access to his games won the lawsuit. Microsoft was ordered to restore his account and pay damages. It's terrifying that something like this can happen, but I'm glad the corporation wasn't allowed to simply do as they please without consequences. Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing, right? Lawsuits will happen, legal precedents will be in place, unless there is sort of a proactive attempt by the platform holders to sort this out. Teasing hilarity. On the topic of permanently eliminating physical in favor of digital, I think regulation is essential if the gaming public are to be looked after. The quote-unquote free market approach has demonstrably not worked at this point, with basics like perpetual access, offline access, transferability, / inheritability, / resaleability, and lendability, generally MIA, with a few piecemeal exceptions noted. The truth is, with the exception of the PC market, which is far from perfect, there just isn't enough competition to rely on a market-based model delivering. KBAC, I have a very important question. How long do you think Sony can go on being radio silent before they acknowledge the colossal dumpster fire they've created for themselves? Yeah, I mean, when this direct goes public, it would have been presumably 19 days of radio silence from Sony when basically the social media firestorm surrounding that three-paragraph blog continues to... to cause problems for them on basically any kind of social media they put out. The Sony situation, obviously, you know, I just want to stress again, this whole concept of issues with digital quote-unquote ownership, or rather lack of it, and lack of recourse when things go wrong, it's a kind of industry-wide thing at the moment. But John, I'm quite curious about your answer to that question. How long do you think Sony can go on being radio silent before they acknowledge the colossal dumpster fire they've created for themselves?
Forever. No, I actually, I don't know. Given how modern Sony operates, I could see a scenario in which they simply never acknowledge this. And
the thing is, that strategy has actually worked for them.
That's problem. The it does seem to work, and that's... That's actually an interesting, this got me thinking about the difference in approach between Microsoft and Sony a little bit, right? I think the Sony approach of being silent sucks, but for whatever reason, it seems to work. And every time Microsoft gets themselves tangled up in one of these situations, you feel like they're all kind of rushing to respond in some way, which is what you want, but usually the response isn't satisfactory. And it just creates more annoyance. I think in the case of Sony, any response from them would just make people angrier, because I don't think they're going to walk it back anytime soon. I don't think they're going to walk it back, period. And I do put a lot of this blame on the current leadership, because when you actually look at their background, these are finance guys, man. Like, they are there. They want those margins. They want to make that money. They don't give a shit about this. Like, this is what they're here for. And I think that's pretty much where we're at right now. And I don't see that they will reverse it. And when you consider all the talk about the handheld thing, right? And even rumors like, oh, that's going to be the PS6. I'm not sure if that's going to be the case. But if the handheld plays a big part of their plan, then obviously discs aren't going to work there. The big problem here, though, where I think they really screwed up is, one, Microsoft seems like they're going to have some kind of disc to digital option. We don't know if Sony will. They've not said anything, so that's annoying. Two, I don't think that they should have announced killing discs for PlayStation 5. I think they should have just rode that out. And I think when people see the handheld, they would naturally be like, oh, well, you know, what are you going to do, right? Like, you're not going to use Blu-ray discs in a handheld. It would just be obvious that they're not going to produce discs for it. So, like, I feel like they really just made themselves a giant mess here and made all of us angry. I'm angry. And I don't know how they get out of this. I'd be curious to know. I suspect Rockstar was probably not too happy with them either, given that, you know, Rockstar, I don't think, is inherently against physical media. I think the reasons they went with that for GTA 6 are probably different, right? But because this occurred so quickly after that announcement occurred, I think a lot of people also put blame on Rockstar. And it, not that it affected pre-orders, right? Of course, it's that's a game that's too big to fail. But still, it brings some negativity their way that I'm sure they did not welcome. And it's it makes it look like they're complicit in this and that they're the ones that are pushing for it, even though I do think it's completely unrelated.
Oliver, what's your take on this?
Yeah, I don't know. John would be more plugged into this than I am, the current state of the online outrage, because it seems like it is still significant. I mean, obviously, a lot of people send that petition. But in terms of Sony actually changing their mind, I think that the when you actually look at where the pricing lies on retail games versus digital games and where the flows of money are heading, I think you can see that even if the physical market is a small percentage of game sales, Sony would really like it to be 0%. You know, I think that is pretty obvious, and I don't expect them to change their minds about it necessarily, unless there's some like overwhelming backlash they think they couldn't weather. And if they think the alternative would be those gamers not buying into the PlayStation ecosystem, because for all Sony knows, and I'm sure they've done market research on this, those gamers could, many of them at least, could well be headed onto PSN to buy their games from now on, right, despite the outrage. So I don't really know what that situation looks like, but if that's how it looks, I don't really see how Sony is incented to do too much different.
I mean, I was just looking at the petition there, the Don't Kill the Disc petition. It's now at 325,000 signatures. Momentum slowing down slightly, but still 3,600 signed today. So clearly, you know, a lot of people are still wanting to make their voice heard on this particular issue. It's interesting, John, that you were talking about Sony's sort of policy of not engaging, right? And previously, we've kind of criticized Microsoft for over-engaging with outrages and stuff like that. And but I think there is a time where you do actually, you can't ignore the outrage. You do have to actually respect the messages that you're being received from the audience.
Yep.
And you've got to do something. The concept of just sitting there and just carry on as if nothing has happened here, I don't think it's acceptable. But no, I'm willing to bet that they're still going to continue doing it.
It's affecting other games too, and that's a bummer. Like, I've seen people, like, trailers for indie games that have nothing to do with this, right? They're getting bombarded with comments, and they've even had to turn off comments in a lot of their videos and such. And so that's basically like Sony throwing their partners under a bus to some degree. And that sucks.
Right.
So, like, okay. Yeah.
Let's move on. Okay, so a more positive story here. There is going to be a port of Dragon's Dogma 2, and it's something which we were very, very curious to hear about, because obviously it's a game that's not particularly performant on other platforms. There have been issues. But it turns out that a series of optimizations have been made, which should benefit all platforms, but actually increases the viability of a Switch 2 version of Dragon's Dogma. So there was an interview with Eurogamer where some of this stuff was pointed out. And we've got comments here from Naoto Oyama. We've been working not only to improve performance to let the game run on Switch 2, but to improve the current base game versions on other platforms too. In particular, we've been trying to find as many small tweaks as we can so we can build up and have a big performance improvement on consoles when it comes to performance mode itself. That's something we're aiming for with the late August title update that's in the roadmap. For performance mode on consoles, we'll be able to reach 60 frames per second. That means, commensurately, all the effort we've put into the PS5 and Xbox Series XS versions of the game also pay off in the Switch 2 version, and we're currently seeing a minimum 30 FPS performance on that hardware. And in many scenes, it's even higher. So it's a little while to go until the game releases, but it's exceeding our expectations on Switch 2, and I hope the players agree we've done a great job again with bringing this game to that platform. Oliver, this is seems like a net win, right?
Yes, I am concerned a little bit about this, though. I am concerned because you look at the language here. Minimum 30 frames per second rate performance in that hardware, and in many scenes, it's even higher. My concern is that we're getting another unlocked frame rate Capcom special with this one, because that's been the case for every single RE Engine title that shipped on Switch 2. Pretty much, I mean, maybe barring one or two, obviously Devil May Cry 5 hit a lock 60 frames per second, but if you put it into 120 hertz mode, it would run unlocked there, so it was also unlocked in a sense. And the footage they've published doesn't inspire too much confidence, because they've published two versions of this update trailer, one presumably representing the current generation console or PC experience, one representing Switch 2, and the Switch version is clearly running unlocked, close to 30 FPS most of the time. Has some downgrades, like less ground clutter, worse textures, worse shadow maps, nothing too crazy, but definitely things that indicate that it is indeed the Switch 2 version. Simpler foliage, it looks okay enough, but that unlocked frame rate is annoying, because even though this might be an impressive port in some respects, I'm not interested in playing that too much. Like, I've been impressed with a lot of Capcom Switch 2 ports, in the sense that, like, Resident Evil 9 looks really good on Switch 2, and runs acceptably well, but the fact that it runs unlocked, it's not where I want to be with a title on Switch 2. It's just not something I enjoy. I have enjoyed for a very long time. So I hope they change their mind or introduce a 30 FPS cap that actually works or something like that. And I'm also just thinking, like, in general, I don't know, maybe this is an unfair critique to Lodge, but, you know, Dragon's Dogma 2, is that really a game you'd want on Switch 2? I'd also think that of, like, Space Marine 2, right? Very CPU intensive current generation titles that might need big cutbacks to things like NPC density. Right? Famously, Dragon's Dogma 2 has very poor NPC draw in the towns. Who knows how bad that would be on Switch 2. You know, they might need considerable cuts thrown in Switch 2, and I kind of wonder if those would actually be good experiences. Now, both are coming to Switch 2, of course, so perhaps they are good experiences in some sense. But yeah, I would just be kind of a little cold on this one. But I mean, hey, if they can deliver a lock 30 FPS mode, even as an option, and deliver acceptable visual quality, that's a big win for sure. But I kind of don't think they're going to get there.
That's interesting, because basically all of the comments in that interview are kind of saying we have got there.
But unlocked, right? If they get there and it's unlocked, that's a different story than if they get there and they manage to lock it down, right?
Was it Dragon's Dogma 2 or Monster Hunter that had the 30 FPS lock?
Dogma Monster, but it was bad.
Right,
Monster Hunter had a correctly frame-paced 30 FPS lock. Dragon's Dogma had an incorrectly frame-paced 30 FPS lock. Very, very broken. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see why they can't have the option across the board. I mean, certainly maybe there are some games where they deem it inappropriate, but for a game like Dragon's Dogma, sort of kind of makes sense, right?
Should have it.
What do you think, John?
Yeah, so this is an interesting thing overall, and it's a very good thing to see, because back when the Switch 2, I think, was still in development or just coming out, she got word about some of this stuff from people within Capcom. And the word on the street was that Dragon's Dogma 2 was proving to be not really feasible on the platform at the time. But I think what we've seen here is that the engineers have continued to make both strides on the engine side and just on the game itself. And I kind of feel like this directly connects to the experience with Dragon's Dogma 2 as a whole. When I first played it at TGS before it was released, you know, obviously it's an in-development build, but usually frame rate targets, you know, you're trying to aim for something at that time. But on a PS5, the game was running sub 30 pretty much all the time. It was like 20, 25. It felt like a PS3 game. It was very, very choppy, actually. Not good. It launched. It was still not great, but it was significantly better, I would say, than that build from like 6 months prior. And then they've continued to optimize it. The game is running a lot better already. It seems like they're still working towards it. So I feel like all the changes they've made as they note, benefit both current players and, you know, players on the current platforms, but also helped make this more feasible now on the Nintendo Switch 2. The game is just in a far more optimized state, and that benefits this. So now we actually do seemingly have a great version on Switch, and I really hope that the one thing that they add is, as you noted, a properly paced 30 FPS cap option. I think that would make a big deal, because like with the motion blur and everything, it should be... I can't remember if it actually had motion blur in gameplay, though. But either way, like 30 FPS cap would be much more preferable to a completely unlocked, unsteady frame rate, because I don't believe they're going to get to 60 on this. I mean, we'll see. Maybe we'll be wrong. I'd love to be wrong on that, but that feels like a bit too much considering how it runs everywhere else, even with the optimizations. But who knows? I'm glad it's coming. I'm glad it's getting a second shot. I think the original game had, you know, there was a lot of good stuff about it, but it did fall short, I think, of some expectations, and it feels like Dark Arisen might possibly be able to flip that a little bit, and I hope they can sort of rescue it. Both this and Monster Hunter, I think, went through that sort of period, right, where they launched in states that were uncharacteristically not great for Capcom, whereas most Capcom games, I feel, launch, and they're just awesome out of the gate, like zero complaints.
Yeah.
These had some issues, and especially in Japan, they were kind of rejected, but it feels like they're trying to make right on it, which I think is awesome. As an aside, though, man, I haven't been to Eurogamer's page in a while, and that's the link you posted, right? We used to post on Eurogamer. That was our home. And, man, the experience, there's, like, raid ads everywhere for me, so it's, like, all about roach killing, like, all around the borders of the page.
Not Raid Shadow Legends?
No, not Raid Shadow Legends. No. Raid the roach spray. And they're playing all these like videos and stuff that are like making Chrome eat more memory. And they've implemented, I didn't realize this, they implemented one of my worst things is the infinite scrolling, where as you scroll, it keeps loading in new stuff. I don't know, that drives me nuts. I feel like infinite scrolling is one of the worst things that has ever existed on the internet. It's like, it gives me that same feeling you get from like Backrooms kind of stuff, where it just feels like this endless pit of despair that you don't understand why, how, or where it will go. It just keeps going somehow. I'd much rather have finite pages where it's clear where you're at in a structure. So, yeah.
I don't mind infinite scroll. I do mind adverts for Raid. I don't suppose you've been searching for
no.
Anti-insect stuff.
I mean, thankfully I'm in Germany, and it's a very, that's one of the best places in the world for not having those problems I've found. But, wow. There it is, nonetheless.
I'm just looking at Eurogamer now, and it seems to think I want a new car. and I'm not buying a Nissan Qashqai, that's for sure. Or a Renault Kangoo van. That's what it's serving up to me at the moment. That's awesome. I'm going to screenshot that for posterity, I think. That's just awesome. Yeah, I mean, ads... tricky business because
you need it, right? It can be annoying, but the thing is, though, is I don't mind ads when they're both not overly distracting and also for stuff that actually relates to the site. Like if you're advertising games on a game site, like that's fine. I love that. That's whatever. But if you're advertising spray on there, like like no, I'm good.
Beggars can't be choosers. I mean, this is why. I mean, I think we've got probably have similar things happening on our site. But the point is that if you're a supporter, you don't get any ads at all. We've got an option there for you to just basically opt out, which is, I think, the preferable route forward there.
Oh yeah. Anyway,
we kind of got sidetracked there quite dramatically. So I guess maybe it's time to move on to our next news topic. Okay, so this story is interesting. When Dying Light the Beast came out, we were actually quite impressed with it, but there was the sense that it was very much a game of the cross-gen style, whereby you could kind of see that, you know, maybe there's some sort of limitations in there that are designed to accommodate the fact that there have to be PlayStation 4 and Xbox One versions. Now, we had an announcement from Techland this week that Dying Light the Beast has actually been cancelled now for PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. 10 months after the current gen version was launched. We had a tweet here from Techland on the official Dying Light account. After careful consideration, we've made the difficult decision that Dying Light the Beast will no longer be released on PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. Dying Light the Beast was built from the ground up to take full advantage of current generation hardware. Its open world, advanced visuals and fluid combat and traversal all depend on processing power and memory that previous generation consoles simply could not provide. As development progressed, it became clear that bringing the game to those platforms would require compromises that would prevent us from delivering the experience we set out to create. This was not a matter of choosing to leave those platforms behind. Rather, it reflected the technical realities of development and our commitment to delivering the best possible experience. We know many of you were looking forward to playing on PS4 or Xbox One and are truly sorry for the disappointment this causes. Anyone who is expecting to play on either platform will be eligible for a refund. Thank you for your understanding and continued support. What do you make of this, Oliver? I mean, ultimately, my take on it is that they tried really hard to do it, and I suspect they probably could have done it, but the return on investment probably sort of vanishes into the ether at that point if you're spending so much time on a version that's only likely to get limited results and limited take-up.
Yeah, that's my feeling too. I'm surprised they elected to do it in the first place, given that,
yeah,
like, what are we talking about? Maybe like 10% more sales? I don't know. Probably not very many from shipping a game on a last generation console in 2026. And the return on investment is muted, especially by the fact this isn't like a Call of Duty or something, right? This isn't like some massive franchise. This is a game that, you know, probably sells single-digit millions of units pretty decently, but nothing too crazy there. Especially given that they have, you know, a bit more of a focus on higher-end machines with like the voxel RTGI they have going on there. I don't know how that would run on last-generation machines. The kind of funny thing about this question is the game was developed originally as DLC for Dying Light 2. Right, that was the original intention. They expanded it out into a standalone title, but you know, a lot of that technical foundation is there. I think you can see that it is, you know, outside of the excellent looking RTGI, it does look like a fairly cross-generation title, developed with similar assets and probably core technology. And also, you know, they were going to ship this game day and date on all console platforms, I believe. Then they announced, right, I believe in September it would be delayed until late 2025. And then Radio Silence since then, and then now they're announcing that it's going to be canceled entirely. So presumably at some point, at least until September 2025, it was technically feasible. And now some months later, they've discovered that it's not. So I kind of wonder if there's maybe a combination here of some legitimate worries about technical feasibility and the difficulty of supporting this game on Xbox One and PlayStation 4 with their limited RAM allotments and lower GPU compute, much weaker CPUs, et cetera, obviously. And then in addition to that, the reality that a PlayStation 4 game or an Xbox One game in 2026 sells rather poorly. I think it might be some combination thereof. Maybe they could have worked the games into a reasonable state. Maybe it wouldn't have met their quality bar. That's another thing. Like, obviously, you can ship a version of a game that doesn't meet the standards for quality that you've established across your titles, right, across the various systems. So, yeah, it could be a variety of factors here. But I don't think anyone will be missing this too much, because I don't know anyone who is really anticipating this game on last generation consoles, because if you're buying new games in 2026, I feel like you probably have a good PC or a console or something that is of the current generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't downplay the importance of Dying Light as a franchise, though. Techland have like made out like bandits on this particular series. Oh, yeah, they've sold a lot of copies of it across both of the games, or now the three games, I guess. The original Dying Light was like massive. I mean, it was one of these games that persisted across the years with great sales. So, I mean, kudos to Techland for being able to develop that and on proprietary technology and, you know, to deliver really good sequels. But, John, I mean, you know, I kind of saw the news and just sort of went shrugged and went on with my day, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is just a case of mathing things out, right? And just determining that, okay, the numbers don't really make sense here. I agree that I think if they really had the desire to make this work on last-gen platforms, they could. I think Dying Light 2, like, I'm actually looking right now at footage of Dying Light 2 running on an Xbox One, and because I hadn't seen that in a while. It looks good. Like, it's really still a beautiful game.
Yeah, I mean, I covered that back in the day.
Yeah. I remember that. Yeah, I had forgotten, but it's like, oh, yeah. I mean, the main thing, obviously, the resolution's quite low, but we're used to that now with like handhelds, right? There is some screen tearing. It dips below 30 at points. So I think the main thing here is that with the Beast, they did, and I spoke to them about this, like they really did push out the rendering on like outdoor environments and foliage heavy scenes quite a bit compared to where Dying Light 2 was. So I have no doubt that the game is a little bit heavier in that regard. So it starts to, you know, the sacrifices necessary start to increase a little bit, and they were already, you know, there in the first place, and just implementing things becomes more expensive and difficult at a certain point, right? Like I remember talking to some developers about Xbox One, and they were like saying, you know, they loved working on Xbox One X, you know, PS4, everything was going well. But when it came to Xbox One, they actually had to put more engineers on a version that they believed would sell worse than the other versions just to get over that hump and get everything working. And I can see why they might look at that and be like, yeah, we don't want to spend resources on this thing anymore in 2026 because PS4 and Xbox One are, you know, pretty old at this point, right? So I don't blame them for this at all. But it does remind me, man, I really like the C engine. I think that's one of Techland's strongest suits. And I really hope that they find a way to continue forward with this because their in-house technology was just awesome.
Right. Okay. Yes. Wasn't there talk of the moving to Unreal Engine?
There was, and I really hope that doesn't come to pass. We'll see what happens, I guess. But I'm so tired of hearing studios say, oh, we're going to make the switch to Unreal. It's just, we need to not have every game run on Unreal. And I still think that in terms of hiring and bringing in engineers, you can essentially play to a different field if you have your own in-house technology, right? There's a pool of Unreal-focused guys, and then there's a pool of guys that want to make stuff that's not Unreal. And I do think that is a different talent pool to some degree, right? And I hope they can continue it because, yeah, it's a very robust engine. It supports ray tracing or not. The RTGI they used in Dying Light 2 was really good on the PC. And, of course, the Beast took that even further. It's just it's a handsome game, what can I say? It's got this really gritty... Mm-hmm. It's the kind of visual design that reminds me of stuff like Stalker, the original Stalker, but obviously, you know, more modern, or just has that look to it. I really like that.
Yeah, I mean, this whole decision doesn't really surprise me at all. I do wonder whether they could have done a PS4/Pro version and just skipped on Xbox, similar to the way Capcom worked with Resident Evil back in the day. But, you know, obviously the decision has been made, and I think it's probably on balance the right one. Let's move on. Okay, so we had a big hardware release this week. Well, kind of big. I mean, there's not too many hardware releases happening in the gaming space at the moment. We do have, though, the Ryzen 7 7700X3D. It's effectively identical to the last generation 7800X3D. There are some minor changes, though. Basically, you know, same configuration, 8 cores, 16 threads. Has that X3D cache, that all-important X3D cache, positioned as a more sort of mainstream offering compared to the mighty 9800X3D. It's good. We've got a review on digitalfoundry.net. I have rendered out the benchmark data that we'll produce for that particular review. I'm going to start talking about prices, though, because AMD has re-released the 5800X3D at $350, which is really not impressive. You know, the DDR4 AM4 platforms are, you know, crying out for you know, a top-end processor at a reasonable price point. So we got this bizarre situation where the 5800X3D is less performant than the 7700X3D, but costs more money. However, the thing is that, you know, the 7700X3D isn't that much cheaper than the 7800X3D. So, you know, it's fine, it's good, but, you know, there's been no real attempts to sort of introduce value here, so to speak. This is kind of highlighted by the fact that I can get a 7800X3D for, in fact, I just did it earlier, AliExpress will sell me one for £187, something like that, which is less over £100 cheaper than the official UK price for the 7700X3D. So, yeah, that's not particularly great, but it's a good product, right? Because, you know, 7800X3D has always been a good product. I'm just going to kick off with some benchmarks here to give you an idea of how it sort of stacks in terms of the other X3D products out there. Baldur's Gate 3, the classic benchmark here. So we've got like automated benchmarks that automate the process of running through the city to really sort of stress test the streaming systems here. We're running at 1080p resolution and we're using a 1490 here to isolate CPU performance. And it's, you know, this is good stuff. I mean, it's 28% faster than the 5800X3D, which is good. The 7800X3D, basically the same, 2% faster. 9800X3D, 21% faster. So this is pretty good, right? Because you've got like clear gradations of performance there, price versus performance. It kind of makes sense, and it's good, you know. We don't have an automated run for Crimson Desert yet, so this one is manual, and it is the bug hill test that John pioneered in our very first Crimson Desert coverage. It hammers the CPU on PS5 Pro.
Oh, yeah.
So it's still, but it's still a big workout for modern PC CPUs. You got the same hierarchy, though. The 7700X3D is 14% ahead of 5800X3D. The 7800X3, 5% faster, 14 points ahead for 9800X3D. So, yeah, I mean, you know, the hierarchy remains, but the actual impact to the CPU performance makes to the gameplay experience will very much change on a game-by-game basis if you're CPU limited. But in this area on Crimson Desert, I'm pretty sure most users will be. But, you know, you can see other results. Far Cry 6, for example, this is all sort of single-core stuff. 7700X3D, 12% faster than 5800X3D. A 25% increase if it's 9800X3D over 7700X3D. So I can continue on. I'd recommend going over to digitalfoundry.net to see all of the results that Will's got here. And I guess for those watching the video version of this, we can have some more benchmark B-roll running as we discuss this. You know, the takeaway is pretty clear, I think. 5800X3D, you get varying levels of enhancement with the 7700X3D, but perhaps not enough to make you trash your existing system. 9800X3D is the game changer there. But, you know, I'm still kind of baffled as to why this product exists, because it is basically the same as the 7800X3D. Maybe it's easier to make with the lower clock speeds and whatnot. It is a bit more efficient, but there's no price win for the consumer in buying this over the 7800X3D. It's kind of like, you know, you pay a bit more, you get a bit more. I just don't understand why they just didn't cut the price of the 7800X3D to begin with. And also, of course, they're just general price issues with what AMD is offering up here. But, you know, what could I say? There's basically price issues everywhere in the hardware space at the moment. But, you know, the concept that I can save over £100 by buying 7800X3D from AliExpress. Now, you might say, okay, that may be an unreliable source, but I've bought CPUs from there before, yeah, and I've never had any problems. I got like a 5600X for like £70, 5700X3D for £130. That was back in the good old days, right? But even so, the concept of buying elsewhere and saving a lot of money continues. Well, that's my spiel out of the way, Oliver. Curious what you make of all of this.
Well, kind of like the 5700X3D, this seems like a near clone of the 7800X3D in terms of spec, substantially at least, and then in terms of performance, where it seems to trail by fractions, fractions of anything meaningful, you know, a couple points here, a couple points there, nothing too significant for the most part. And like you said, the 9800X3D is truly a step above, although it can be, you know, its impact can be more modest in some games than others. In titles like Far Cry, you're seeing a big uplift. In other titles that might be more GPU limited, like I think you had Forza Horizon 5 pegged as a pretty small performance increase there. But in general, you know, I mean, I'm glad to see more units, more X3D units hitting circulation in various SKUs, various configurations. It's certainly encouraging, but you do need to see prices normalized down to something that's reasonable for a device with a notionally decreased spec versus the 7800 X3D, or else it's not worth it. But of course, you can't really totally predict what retail channels are going to look like. And in this world of people kind of exceeding MSRPs, and in some cases, rarely going under MSRPs in some cases, you can't always predict exactly where prices are going to lie. And they're not always going to be rationalized within a certain line, right, across all vendors. So that's something that hopefully over time you are going to see 7700 X3D prices decrease to a level where it actually makes sense as a reasonable purchase to buy over its higher end counterpart.
Yeah, I agree. That is generally what seems to happen. The market steps in and affects price corrections on MSRPs. The most recent one being the Radeon RX 9070 GRE, which, you know, I reviewed it. Nobody seemed to care about it particularly, but I did review it. And the takeaway was there that, you know, you can play games with this thing and it's great, but, you know, the pricing is such that if you spend a little bit more, you get a whole lot more by buying an RX 9070. And lo and behold, I saw earlier this week that GRE is now sort of slightly drifting down in price to where the price versus performance argument kind of makes a bit more sense. So, yeah, the market in the PC component side does generally tend to step in and make the corrections that the MSRPs don't. John, thoughts?
Not really much thoughts specifically on that. I just have a question for you, Rich. If you had to pick the undisputed best AMD CPU of all time on a whim, what would you go with?
Man, you've got a lot to choose from there. I am going to go for the 5800 X3D. There are many, many candidates, of course, you know, going all the way back to the old Athlon days where, you know, AMD had one up on Intel, which was awesome.
Athlon,
right? You know,
64, baby. Woo!
Yeah. But, you know, it's a bit sad that the 5800 X3D has come back at this inflated price point because the concept of what that processor was doing back in the day when it first came out was just phenomenal. It was really, really great idea. It was basically, we've come up with this great idea to boost CPU performance in games, and we're going to let you run this processor on any of our existing AM4 boards, pretty much any, all of them got a BIOS update. And what it's done is to extend the longevity of the AM4 platform in a way that almost seems sort of too pro-consumer based on the kind of cynical response there is to just about anything the likes of AMD, Intel, or NVIDIA do these days. You know, there's the sense now that when a new product comes out, there's, you know, you've got to prepare yourself for being done over with a bad deal. But, you know, you look at what the X3D was doing, the 5800 X3D, and it was like, it was genuinely a pro-consumer move based on exciting technology that actually was making a big difference to gaming in an area where, you know, typically you're relying on your GPU to provide meaningful upgrades. But actually, as it turns out, this generation has thrown up a number of games where you're very, very much CPU limited. And Crimson Desert is like, you know, the most recent example. But, you know, Space Marine 2, for example, another game where you're super, super CPU limited. You know, you've got X3D that actually provides a meaningful uplift. And it arrived at a pretty good time at a pretty good price. I mean, it's kind of crazy, though, that I did buy the X3D. It was a Christmas present to myself. I've just bought it because it's like I wanted to support the moves that AMD were doing there. And also because I had an existing system that had like a Ryzen 5 3600 in it, and it doubled performance. This was like awesome, you know? So yes, that would be my sort of pick as the best AMD CPU. And also what heartens me about it is that the X3D thing wasn't sort of put back in the shelf, so to speak, on subsequent generations. Mm-hmm. AMD continued to iterate. They continued to improve it. And the 9800 X3D and the CPU I've got now, the 9950 X3D, they're just awesome, right? I think they're really, really good. And I'm happy that AMD continued with that particular project. And I'm really interested to see what they're going to come up with next for Zen 6. But, you know, 7700X3D, it's okay. It's pretty good. It's a solid choice. Thank you, AMD, I guess. But, you know, the pricing side of things does give you pause, I think it's fair to say. All right, let's move on. Okay, really interesting story that came out from ZDNet Korea this week. Nintendo is reportedly evaluating an OLED version of the Switch 2. Yes, it's happening, hopefully. I say happening. It says here the project has not received final approval and remains under internal review. John, according to this report, I'm just reading the summary of it on video cards here. Mentions an OLED panel, 1920x1080 resolution, as you would expect. So it's, you know, basically what's seemingly a drop-in replacement for the LCD model. Reportedly, Samsung are going to be supplying the panel. This is music to your ears, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've been kind of holding out hope that they would do an OLED revision. That actually seems like a great way to, increase the prices again to make up for all the other issues without, you know, upsetting too many people. Because, like, hey, it's a premium one.
But, it's what they did last time around.
Yeah. That's fine. I mean, that would be an awesome upgrade. I'm really hoping for that. And it would also, not only would it fix problems with the blurriness of the current LCD, but it would also mean you get proper actual HDR in handheld mode rather than the fake HDR we have now. I'd also wonder if they would do any adjustments to the VRR side of things. Probably not. I'm sure that's baked into the software side. But either way, you know, great news. I'm really hoping for it. And that'll make the Switch 2 significantly more interesting for me as a portable device.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Oliver.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see if this does materialize, but I do think to make it worth it, like properly worth it and properly exciting, they do need to do more than they did with Switch 1 OLED. I think they do need to deliver a really good HDR experience here. I'd really love to see like 1,000 nits peak and maybe, you know, at least 400 or 500 nits full white, like something really nice. A great panel, or at least a good panel, because by like 2028, you know, we're not talking about anything too crazy, and obviously, you know, the Steam Deck OLED hit a 1,000 nits in HDR quite convincingly. And portable devices nowadays, like my iPhone, can do like 2,000 or 3,000 nits in HDR. Like, they're getting pretty crazy. So I would hope for at least a pretty good HDR experience. Sticking with 1080p makes a lot of sense. There's no benefit to going higher, really. And 1080p is much more rational now than it seemed at launch, because Switch 1 software scales really nicely with the handheld boost mode. But I'm not too sure this will happen, though, based on this story, unfortunately, because it seems like this information is kind of supplier side. Maybe I'm reading a little bit too much into it, but it sounds like Samsung is pitching Nintendo, hey, we've got this panel, we've got this great rigid OLED panel that won't cost you too much. Wouldn't you like to use it in your products? And Nintendo is kind of like, well, maybe yes, maybe no, we'll see. And I think part of that is because Samsung is in a position, I've been looking into this recently, but like the rigid OLED panel market, I think, is tapering off somewhat, because all the smartphone manufacturers and tablet manufacturers are all going to flexible OLEDs. They're all using flexible OLED panels. Flexible OLEDs, even if you put them in a rigid panel assembly, they're still thinner, and you can still fit much smaller bezels on them. So they're much better for these small portable devices. But like the Steam Deck OLED, I think, uses a rigid panel. So there are still some rigid panels out there. But yeah, I would be very curious to see if this does ship. I know that the prices would have to be higher. I accept that. Maybe this would be like $100 premium or something. I don't know what it would look like at that point, what the final price would look like at that point. But I think I and people like John and myself would gladly be liberated from that money, maybe not gladly, but certainly willing to do so, just because the Switch 2 does not have a very good screen on a lot of metrics. Maybe the only metric where it does okay is just overall brightness. It is fairly bright, but almost any other metric you look at on the panel, it is mediocre to poor, I would say. So a panel that can convincingly alleviate all those problems would be a game changer, I think, for the device.
How much would you pay, John, for a Switch 2 OLED?
I mean, I would certainly pay an extra, you know, $50-$100 over the current price.
Okay.
Honestly, you know, if it needed to be more, I wouldn't like that, but it'd still be willing. Like, the thing is like the LCD panel is just so bad that it actually deters me from wanting to use that system in handheld mode. I know people always get angry when I say that, but I'm sorry. That's just how it is. Like, if you notice that problem with the persistence blur, like the response time blur, like, it's just, it's a problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oliver, how much extra would you pay for an OLED switch to?
I would pay like $100 or $150, but if I was a little bit more enterprising, I'd say, hey, Rich, I need this for coverage because I need to count the frame rates on the panel. So just buy it for me. Buy it for me, please. That's what I would do.
On the whole round, well, one, baby.
There was the situation that because Nintendo changed their system of supplying review code to journalists back in the day, that they did supply OLED units to reviewers. For that reason. So, you know, maybe that will happen. Who knows? We've got a question here from Darshako in brackets. Dan, lads, what do you think to the fresh rumblings about a Switch 2 OLED model coming sooner rather than later, i.e. 2027, 28? Could it be Nintendo's trying to time the refresh to coincide with Sony's new handheld? Why else might they have brought it forward in this climate? Surely a cost down light model would be a bigger priority, even if the savings are only marginal. I don't think Nintendo really care what Sony is doing at any point. They, you know, basically have made an entire successful business by going down their own path, right? I don't think they really care what anybody is doing, what anybody else is doing. And it's similar with Sony. You know, one of the sort of big takeaways that I had in any of my various dealings with Sony when we're talking about their new consoles and stuff, they honestly don't, you know, they didn't care what Microsoft were up to. They didn't really want to talk about it. They didn't really consider it a priority. They just sort of focused on what they were doing. I think it's nice that there is a rivalry out there and that there is competition, but ultimately a lot of it, I think, is in the users' heads rather than the actual platform holders. I think it's quite an interesting situation there. As to what is actually going to happen here, I think we're in a situation where new models were built into the plan right from day one. Similarly with the original Switch, I think, you know, basically there were optimizations for better SoC processes that could come along further on down the line. They were fully aware of that. They went with what was most economically viable for them. And in both the case of Switch 1 and Switch 2, it's turned out to be a canny move, right? They didn't need mm-hmm. to go to 4 nanometer. Right. I mean, it would have been really, really nice, but they didn't need to. But they've got options going forward for revised models that will have better battery life, all of that sort of jazz, potentially better performance, although I doubt we'll see it. So, you know, I think that was always the plan. I do expect that there will be mid-generation refreshes because the nature of the changes there, you know, it's such that they can still do those refreshes because, you know, storage and you know, that sort of thing, memory, it's not really going to change. So they, you know, it's still got a runway there for producing those extra models. Would you like to see a cost reduced light model that's handheld only, John, if it had a decent screen?
I mean, sure, why not? If they wanted to do it, I'm not sure that the original Switch Lite was as big a success as they might have liked compared to the other models, but, you know, a smaller, more compact version like that could be cool.
Mm. Yeah,
I'm not against it.
Oliver, what do you think about the light model? I still think there is an argument to be made for the home micro console.
I'm a fan of the original Switch form factor and the original Switch 2 form factor. I find the light models are just a little bit, like, they're cute, but I don't know that it really, like, they still don't really fit in pockets. So I don't really think they're that much more portable. You still need, like, a dedicated purse or carrying thing or whatever, as far as I'm concerned, for those consoles generally. So I'm not such a huge fan of that. Plus, I like to put cases and attachments and grips on my Switches, so it doesn't really work out as well with the smaller Lite model. But if they can ship one for a reasonably lower price, I think it's a great way to expand the market And I would expect them. I mean, it seems like such a natural thing to do. I would expect it to happen if they can justify it technologically. But at the same time, to get a Switch Lite, you did need a die shrink, right? To actually get there and get acceptable battery life. So it's kind of contingent on, do they get like a 5-nanometer port or something of this technology? Maybe like a 7-nanometer port would be sufficient, but certainly a better nanolithographic process and a better TDP on that chip, or else I don't think you're going to be able to make it work within a smaller enclosure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay, let's move on. So our final topic for this particular DF Direct, we're going to go back in time. We're going to examine Will Judd's Digital Foundry time machine. This is a really nice site that Will developed for us that enables us to see what we were doing on the video side 1 year ago, 5 years ago, and perhaps depressingly 10 years ago. And there's some really interesting stuff that came up this week. 5 years ago, we were talking about Microsoft Flight Simulator on Xbox.
Oh, yeah.
We were talking about Ratchet & Clank getting a 40 FPS mode on PlayStation 5, which was kind of like a really interesting development at the time. Hasn't quite sort of become the sort of the go-to mode that we thought, you know, it would, but still seems to crop up quite a lot in various games. Yeah, I was just actually looking back at 1 year ago, DF Direct Weekly 222, Oblivion Remastered Fixed, and the thumbnail seems to be Alex laughing at the mere concept, me looking completely manic about it, and Oliver looking completely suspicious of the whole concept, and basically it wasn't fixed. So that was quite amusing. But it's when we go back 10 years that we see some quite interesting stuff, because we did a simulation of the PlayStation 4 Pro using basically an underclocked RX 470, which basically came out with the result being, yeah, it can probably do 1440p, but which did indeed turn out to be the case. But obviously, you couldn't do checkerboarding on or TAAU on an RX 470. So that was kind of like missing information there. But the thing which caught my eye was the fact that we actually revealed the specifications for the Nintendo NX, which turned out to be the Switch 1. There was a lot of interesting and angered response to that particular reveal, because everything we'd seen from the NVIDIA Tegra on Shield Android TV, well, let's just say the gaming experience wasn't particularly great there. And a lot of people were expecting to see an AMD processor in there, and there wasn't. And we were fully happy with our sources at that point. John, going back in the day, I think the reason that we actually produced this report at that point was because there had been some sort of developer briefing in Nintendo of Europe's Frankfurt HQ that we became aware of, and it became obvious at that point that the spec was locked and this was it. There was hope that, you know, X1 was going to be just kind of like an early dev kit version.
Right.
But that wasn't the case. It was just Tegra X1 all along. It was a really interesting time to actually go ahead with that story.
That's the Nintendo way. And I'd say they sure did a lot with it. Those special NVIDIA APIs and everything really helped out a lot. And the Switch has been awesome. It's funny, I also see right around that same time, we did an analysis of Resident Evil 5 on the Shield Android TV, which is also Tegra X1. And it's pretty dire. That the Shield TV, it would lead you to believe that the Switch would be less capable than it ended up being, I would say.
Yep. And that's the thing, right? Because obviously further on down the line, we revealed the clock speeds for the Switch, where the Tegra X1 was actually running significantly slower than the Shield Android TV. And it's like, okay, slightly problematic. But then, you know, as you quite rightly say, you know, the concept of having dedicated APIs, dedicated developer environment, developers specifically targeting that hardware for their games, it actually turned out all right in the end.
It really did.
Yeah, and it was the case similarly with Switch 2, where, you know, you looked at the simulations, you looked at the core hardware there, and there were concerns, but, you know, ultimately we'd kind of seen what would happen with Switch 1 and the relatively meager resources developers had available, but they did great stuff with it. Oliver, you weren't with us back in the day. I'm curious if you saw this result back there, this report back then, and what you thought about it.
I did see it, but I was overdosing on hopium, thinking it would be the X2 at that time. I was really thinking.
I think we all were.
It's got to be the X2. It's got to be the X2, which actually maybe steeled me a little bit later on when the Switch 2 rumor cycle was coming around. And there was all the talk of, you know, a 4-nanometer or 5-nanometer processor. At that point, it was kind of like, well, I think we've seen this song and dance before. And I know how it ended up, not to my benefit, not to my enjoyment. But in the end, you know, Switch 1 ended up producing some great results, did really well with 7th-gen software, did pretty well with a lot of 8th-gen games as well, delivered a great platform for a wide variety of Nintendo titles, including famously just about every single Wii U title that ever existed of any note on that platform. And yeah, I was also just thinking about Resident Evil 5, because Resident Evil 5 on Shield was a bit of a disaster. And if that was taken as a prelude to Switch 1 performance, that wasn't so promising. But on Switch 1, it ran okay. It was unlocked, but good frame rates. But now on Switch 2, if you run that same game, you can get like a locked 1080p 60fps, even in handheld mode, basically, now with the handheld boost mode. So yeah, I think that the legacy of Switch 1 is definitely encouraging from a technological perspective, for sure, when you consider how meager the hardware was within it. But at the same time, you know, I am glad we have a sequel to that console now, because everything that's not like a first party Nintendo title on Switch 1 nowadays is pretty heinous, I would say, or very, very low budget for the most part, I would have to say.
I think the thing that another memory that I have of producing this coverage, because we were working with Tom Phillips on Eurogamer, you know, he had the same information that we did. And we kind of assumed at that point that everybody knew that there had been this developer briefing at in Frankfurt, and the specs were kind of like generally known by everyone in the press. And it was a case of, do we go ahead with this? Are we going to get scooped? To what extent do we fully believe that those are actually, that is actually the specifications there? You know, whenever we make a big story like this, the amount of sort of introspection and double checking of sources, multiple sources, you know, it's quite an endeavor to actually put a report out there that is going to be where you know it's going to be that contentious, but you know that it is ultimately the truth. So, yeah, interesting times for sure. John, I'm just looking at the other stuff we were putting out 10 years ago. A couple of DF Retro stuff you might want to talk about there.
Oh, yeah. We had the the Castlevania Symphony of the Night video with me floating in a CRT. That was always a fun one because of the... I picked up the Saturn version sometime before that and was shocked to see how they accomplished it. There was that whole thing with the artwork being pre-scaled, where to fill the Saturn screen, because the Saturn didn't support the low resolution 256 by 224 mode the game was designed with. And I think it was designed with that because some of the stuff was derived from the PC Engine game, and that was the resolution most PC Engine games ran at. But since Saturn didn't support it, they had to pre-scale the art. And because the resolution's so low, that meant basically adding in an extra line of pixels, like every so many pixels. And it just makes it kind of chunky and not great. So that was interesting. So even though there's been hacks and improvements on it, it's still limited by the art. There was that launch video I did. I think I did that one just because of the talk about the Switch, right?
Right.
And then
yeah, it was.
We previewed Sonic Mania. I talked about that for the first time, which turned out to be one of my favorite games ever. So I love it still. I was just playing it recently on the Wii. No less.
The Wii?
Yeah.
So, you know, that little controller?
Playing on the Wii at 240p on a CRT, it feels real nice.
Just one final note about Will Judd's time machine here. John, looking at those DF Direct thumbnails from 5 years ago, are you starting to feel old?
Yeah, very. Yeah, we're all getting old. Can I say... Time,
it's
man.
A sobering
it's,
thought.
It's brutal.
Yeah, time.
When we look back in 10 years from now, oof.
Crazy stuff. And on that somber note, I guess we should bring an end to this particular edition of DF Direct Weekly. So please do like, subscribe, share on the off chance you enjoyed it. Ring bells for things that may or may not happen. DF supporter program, though, at patreon.com/digitalfoundry. Support the team in what we do. It's really, really important. But that's all from us on this one. Thanks for watching and supporting Digital Foundry. And perhaps inevitably, we shall see you very, very soon.